This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome to the New Books Network's Library Science Channel. My name is Hillel Yadin. I am your host today, and I am here to talk about On the Digital Humanities, Essays and Provocations with Stephen Ramsey. Would you like to introduce yourself and the book and your general background?
Sure, yes. As you say, I'm Stephen Ramsey. Most people call me Steve. I am an associate professor of English and a fellow at the Center for Digital Research in the Humanities at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And I have a book that is out now from University of Minnesota Press on the Digital Humanities, Essays and Provocations. And I've been involved in the digital humanities community in one way or another since the 1990s or so, late 90s, I would say.
And can you tell us about the format of the book?
Yeah. It's really a collection of essays. And I wish I had a good origin story, right? You're doing this sort of thing. People say, you know, how did this book come about? It came about really because I wrote a book in 2011 called Reading Machines, and that book was really a defense of digital humanities. Didn't say that on the cover, but that's really what it was. People were a little nervous about digital DH. They were worried or confused or weren't sure what this was and what the digital meant for the humanities. And so I wrote this book, and that kind of put me on the speaker circuit, right? People were inviting me to come and explain myself. And I think what they were, this is really luck on my part. They really invited me to come say, you know, well, answer these questions for us. What's the field about? And that sort of thing. So I wrote a lot of talks where I tried to talk about what I thought the big issues were in digital humanities, what the challenges were, what was exciting and hopeful about it, all of that kind of thing. And now I think good, smart, conscientious scholars, what they do is when they go give a talk like that, they come home and they say, you know what I'll do? I'll turn this into an article and publish it somewhere. But I never do that. I just sort of throw it in a drawer and move on to the next thing. So for the last few years, I had this idea, you know, I should probably take all that stuff and revisit it, work it, and see what is still relevant, what questions are still outstanding, and publish them all as one collection. And fortunately, an editor at the University of Minnesota Press thought that was a good idea too. And so here we are. So that's really where the book came from. I will also admit too that the pandemic had something to do with it. I found, and maybe we can talk about this. I found during lockdown, I found the inability to go to a physical library was way more troublesome with
that. I
planned the whole, you know, sort of research project, and I found that I had every faith that the online resources would perfectly fine, but actually I found it really hard. So this project seemed a little more doable, you know.
Well, I think that's actually really interesting and relevant to the big questions. If you want to talk more about what was that disconnect between the digital resources and hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, especially since I think that's quite up your alley as well. So maybe we should talk about that at some point. Yeah.
All right. So the core of your work, or at least, you know, the past 10 or so years that I got from reading the essays, really seems to be about asking questions. Maybe not asking good questions. Maybe that's not, you know, you don't want to put a value judgment on it, but asking productive questions, and really building the tools to enable asking different questions. So what, in your view, does DH offer all of these disparate fields in the humanities that their core methodologies don't, in terms of asking and answering questions?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a few different ways to think about that. I think, you know, one is surely there are some sort of things that we would like to know about as humanists, or that are potentially interesting, or something that are really only tractable with some kind of computer technology, because just the nature of the question. Right around the time I published the first book, Franco Moretti published Graphs, Maps, and Trees, a very, very sort of popular meditation on these subjects. And you know, he made a terrific point, which is that who can even say how many novels were published in Europe in the 19th century? I mean, we just like, is that number, is it 60,000? Is it 100,000? I mean, no one even really knows the answer to that question. But what one thing that is surely the case is that we can't read them all. No one can. No human being could ever sit down and have that kind of, right? So it feels intuitively like computers could help with that kind of, that doesn't mean they do help. It doesn't mean that they are an answer to the kinds of questions we ask in the humanities, but it's at least a suggestive direction, is that computers might come to our assistance when we're trying to get at problems like that. But I think that the business of asking questions actually had more sort of, there was a certain kind of pressure on digital humanities in the early days that amounted to saying, is this the humanities at all? Is it asking the kinds of questions that the humanities ask? Really a kind of question, are we in the same category? Are we in the same class? Are we speaking the same language? And that's a more complicated question, right? Do computers, does the use of computers in the humanities yield the kinds of things we want to, does the use of technology to study the human record, does that take us into territory that takes us out of humanistic discourse completely? And my firm contention to this day is that it does not, absolutely does not. But plenty disagree. Plenty disagree with me on that subject to this day. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mentioned that I one of the things I had to do is go back through all this stuff I written and see what was still relevant and what spoke to the present moment. I had no trouble finding people who as of yesterday, I was like, up to the present moment, quite convinced that this digital stuff is destroying the humanities. It's destroying English departments, the history departments, everything. So apparently I haven't won the argument, but I suppose I don't expect it.
Well, so what are the humanistic questions then, in your view, that the computerized technology is speaking to? What is your rebuttal to all of your critics, I should say?
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's at least I think two sides to my rebuttal. One sort of slightly irritated, and one I think more the slightly irritated response is, do you really want this not to exist? I've always wondered, you know, in the more brutal attacks on the field, I've always wondered. So do I understand you? There are people out there who are interested in exploring what various technologies might mean for the study of the human record. You think they should stop? This seems to be an aggressively anti-intellectual position. I mean, even if they turn up nothing, it would be like immoral. I mean, there are a few academic subjects that I find a little dull. I won't say what they are. They're not really to my taste.
Gesture at some in the book. Anyone listening is curious.
What's that?
Anyone listening is curious which one you might be able to pick it out if you read the book.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few academic subjects that bore me a little, and I'm very glad that people are out there doing them. I don't want people to stop. I mean, it just seems, there's a big community of people who are interested in this. They seem to have, they have the credentials certainly, and they seem to have the intellectual integrity of, you know, to, they seem to have intellectual integrity that they're not asking these questions out of opportunism or something. So that's my first kind of sarcastic answer. The second is more subtle, and it's that I really if. When I try to say it's been one of the more fascinating things about my intellectual career is that, you know, the only training I have is as an English professor, as a literary critic, but through luck and happenstance, just the way my career went, I found myself having to think about the humanities a lot, which meant, I think, you know, trying to understand, well, you know, what do historians really do? What's different about art history, or what's different about what do historical archaeologists really do? How do they think about, or classicists or philosophers or any of the, and then the next question is what unites all these folks? And I think what unites all of these folks is that we are all looking for patterns. We're all looking at the human record, however broadly as that can possibly be understood, the human record, whether that's visual or written, folklore, oral histories, all of it, right? What we're trying to find is patterns, regularities, dissonances, and anything that suggests a way of understanding this material as its regularities, the regularities in its behavior over time, whether we're talking about colonialism, or we're talking about the history of a particular text, or we're talking about the way women are represented in Western art, whatever it might be. I think that's where a historian and a literary critic and an historical archaeologist, that's probably where we're all on the same page. And it also means that we are all talking about at the next level up, we're all talking about what interpretation is, what makes an interpretation valid, if there's such a thing as validity in interpretation and so forth. I think that's why, that's why at a digital humanities conference, where you have dozens of people from dozens of disciplines all in the room, I think it's why we can all talk to each other, because we're, even though I might know nothing, and I really do, I know next to nothing about, you know, the work of historical archaeology, I can follow at some level we can talk, we can speak to each other and understand each other, because we do have a common sense.
I do want to go back to this question of interpretation and pattern making. But one thing that what you just said made me think of from the book is this comparison to psychology departments, where side by side you have the talk to me about your childhood psychologists and the cut open a rat's brain psychologists, right? And nobody's saying they're not both doing psychology, but very different. Right. very different methods are coexisting. And do you see, or are you on some level striving for a future where maybe, you know, in a history department, there's the looking at one document for years, historian, and the digital historian, and those are equally valid. And I will keep using historians because I am an archivist.
First of all, I want to publicly apologize to any psychologists I might have offended.
That is more or less a direct quote from the book.
Yes, I did. No, it is a direct quote. I did write it. I hope it's tongue in cheek. It's all, there are in the same department in the story, and there might be an historian who really is trying to pick apart a really sort of tiny event, you know, so trying to understand what happened even on a single day, or what happened at a meeting, or what happened at you might be studying the Berlin conference or the constitutional convention or something, and you know, you've devoted yourself really to a Supreme Court case. There are also historians in that same department who are studying, you know, huge swaths of European history, or you know, the Napoleonic Wars or something like that. And again, that doesn't, they there is something that unites those people. So
there are already very different methods in any department.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But then they don't. This has come up because we were having my department has been having this conversation. I mean, the English is a pretty just in my department. There are, first of all, there are people study all different periods of literature, but there are lit scholars. There are creative writing specialists, poets, novelists. There's also specialists in composition and rhetoric. We all go to different conferences. We all go to different, and the question has come up: what unites all of us? And I think there are things that unite us. We don't just happen to be in the same department. And I think with the humanities too, if we were to create a school of the humanities, and we said, some places have such things like a college of the humanities. Certain things would be in it, and certain things would not. I think we'd get that sorting hat worked out pretty quickly, right? That the chemistry is not probably doesn't belong in the same building as the historians, the literary critics, and the artists.
That's interesting. So back to this, you write in the book that digital humanities facilitates the process of pattern formation. And, you know, a real thread of this is ways that you can pull out patterns to then interpret them. Another thing that is coming to mind that I've been chewing over since I read it is you describing computers as machines that build other machines, which I thought, sorry?
Yeah, I'm writing about that now, actually.
Oh, okay. So before we get into patterns, is there anything you want to say about that? Because I thought that was a very, for me as a, I know very basic Python. That's what I need for my job. That's what I use. But I'm not a programmer. And I thought that was a really useful way of thinking about computers. And if you're writing about it, not to put you on the spot, is there more that you want to say about that in terms of, in general, or in terms of the field?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm writing about some of these issues now, and so I have nothing but half-baked, half-formed thoughts. But I do say something like this to my students every year, that the computer is really not like other machines. It's really, that if we were to sit down and list the most epochal technological innovations ever, or in the last 5,000 years or something, we would rightfully, I could even do a poll with my students, and they'll hit on, you know, the printing press and the steel plow and the clock and, you know, and so forth. But there are different kinds of plows and there are different kinds of clocks and things like that. But the thing about computers is you can make a computer be a clock, and you can also make it be a printing press. You can't quite make it a plow, but you can make it control one. And in fact, every modern plow is in fact controlled by a computer of some sort. That seems to me to put it in a different category of machines, that it's a different kind of thing. When you sit down to write anything in Python, however simple you may regard it, you really are taking this machine and using it to go do some task that it didn't know how to do before you sat down and told it how to do it. I mean, one of the things about my field is that we're often accused, and I see why, but we're often accused of being digital, sort of utopianists or something, that we're sort of we're big fans of technology. And there's a little bit of truth to that. I mean, obviously we're interested in technology, we wouldn't be involved with it, but this idea that we see no downside, to automation. We see nothing negative about Silicon Valley. We see nothing. X, platform formerly known as Twitter. We look at it as absolutely critical. I mean, it could, of course, we understand very. I think we understand very well that yes, you can control a plow. You can also control an atomic weapon system, part of the consequence of being a machine that can create machines is, I think, and here's I want I need to think more carefully through this, but I mean, it can lend itself to good or evil, certainly.
I think often the people who are working most closely with the tools are the ones who are most critical of them. That's absolutely not my impression of digital humanists, that they are not thinking of the negative consequences.
That's good, although I can think of plenty.
plenty of people disagree with me, I know.
I'll tell you something. Tell you something really, really interesting is that I don't know, exaggerated a bit, but I know lots and lots of digital humanists who entertain a great, great fondness for fountain pens and calligraphy and all the book arts and letterpress printing. And some, not, this isn't just an interest. I mean, I can think of a couple people in the field who run full-blown labs where they sort of walk students through the history of printing, and they're full on. I'm thinking of people like Matt Kirschenbaum at the University of Maryland, Ryan Cordell is at the University of Illinois. Both of them run these labs that are full of printing presses, the kind you pull the bar and everything. I think they're interested in the history of technology more broadly. But it's hard not to think that we're also. Maybe try to get off the screens a little bit. I don't want to put words in my mouth, but I mean, I feel that too. I have a pretty sizable collection of fountain pens, and
I mean, the listeners will not be able to see this, but I'm looking at your room right now, full of paper books. even the most devoted digital people are still, engaging with the analog world.
That's another thing I tell my students. You hear this less now. I mean, back when I started, it was sort of like book versus computer. I mean,
my time, but I've read it's course.
And I used to say to my students, I still say it, if I ever invent a technology that is light, portable, cheap, and lasts a couple thousand years, I'll consider my time on this earth well spent, right? I mean, the book is, the Codex book is done really well.
We see this in just the general world. When the Kindle came out, there was all of this doomsday about the end of the print book, and it just never happened. You know, ebooks did not replace books. Books are actually increasing in popularity. You know, people also love ebooks. You know, there's actually no antagonism.
No, I it's true. We didn't, and actually the subject hanging over any such discussion right now, of course, is AI and AI memes. It's hard to recapture. People forget that the moral panic over ebooks, and you know, I mean, people really, you know, very very upset about this. You know, they didn't replace books, as you say, but they also didn't disappear. They didn't. I love ebooks in all kinds of circumstances, especially airplanes. I think ebooks are the greatest.
I read physical books at home, and on my commute, I read ebooks on my tiny little phone that's close to my face. And it's, there's different technologies serve different functions.
Right. And you probably don't feel as if you're making a moral decision when you do.
I really don't.
But it did feel like a
Well, there's also, and this is maybe something that you can speak to more, but this idea that a book is a pure technology, or just a pure reading is a pure pursuit in some way, in a way that computer anything isn't. This is not something that I agree with, but it's certainly something that there's a lot of reverence for the book, in a way that I don't think there is necessarily, at least in the humanities, for these digital technologies.
I wonder about that, though. The internet sort of hit the year I graduated from college. So I went off to college with a typewriter, and then went off to grad school, and the internet appeared. So I'm in this generation that very well remembers the times before computers. And for most of my life, I couldn't imagine anyone feeling nostalgia for computer equipment. I mean, that seemed impossible. You could easily imagine, you didn't have to imagine, you could feel a very romantic attachment to the smell of books and libraries. I think for a lot of us who went into the kind of professions that you and I did, it's a romantic attachment to books and libraries and all of it. And I could not imagine that computers would ever inspire that kind of nostalgia. I think the record is in. There are all these people trying to restore computers from the 60s, the 70s, even the 50s. Retro gaming, 8-bit music. I've been my instincts about this at the beginning, I think, were quite wrong. That people could get very attached to, that only raises more questions. Like, what is it about? Do people get emotionally attached to mops and brooms? Do people get emotionally attached? Like, what is it? Is this maybe something that is maybe not unique to, but seen often with information technology in particular, that we develop strong feelings and even strong emotions around anything that is about us communicating with each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just offer it as a question. I mean, we don't like. It's funny because an essay that did not make it into the book, I talked about this a little bit. It was from way back. Why is it that we don't? I mean, I remember this. I'm really dating myself, but I remember this moment when the world switched to pay at the pump gasoline. Now in New Jersey, I think there's a law that there's no self serve gasoline.
You are correct. I've put my own gas. But it was in my life.
Most of the country, it's fine to pump your own gas. And that was, I mean, there was a time when there was no such thing. And then suddenly everyone could go to the gas station and pull up the car and put in a credit card and pay for gas and leave without ever having any contact with a human being. Similarly, we could use other examples. I mean, the kind of self checkout at grocery stores. Now I would be happy to be corrected on this, but I doubt there was much hand wringing of this sort where people said, you know what, this pay at the pump thing, this self checkout, this is just going to drive us apart. This is just going to represent the breakdown of community and things like that. I think there were arguments against it that had to do with jobs and employment, but not quite the kind of, you know, we're all less human as a result of this technology. You compare that with the telephone. The invention of the telephone created, I mean, you want to talk about moral pain, it's hard to recapture. I mean, people really did say, this may destroy us as a society. That this means we will have less contact with each other. We will become more balkanized in our political opinions. That sound familiar? Right? I mean, real moral pain. And what's the difference? Well, I mean, the telephone was about communication, was information, whereas the gas station. I mean, people might have objected, but not the way.
Yeah, there was. I've seen a lot of sort of commentary on self-checkout and these kinds of things in the way that you're describing, but a different tenor.
Yeah, again, maybe I'm not paying enough attention to the...
No, I think you're right. I think the intensity of it is, I mean, even the other thing that I was thinking about just with books is this apparently still ongoing debate about whether listening to audiobooks is reading, which I think it kind of speaks to a similar question about the print book and its moral value. And I'm firmly on the audio. This is I'll tell you my bias. I think listening to audiobooks is reading. I don't. You are taking in the book, right? But there's all of this, and there's. I'm not in education in any way. I think that there's a lot of this is coming from the education world, where learning to look at words in a row and take them in with your eyes using certain eye movement and processing them is a different skill than listening to an audiobook, for sure. But there is also a real moral debate about does it count as reading in its essential form? And it's like, who is counting and who are we counting for? I mean, people are not getting at those questions before we talk about audiobooks. But this is okay. Let me get back real quick to the point I was making, which is the self-checkout debates and commentary. I mean, even compared to the reading books versus listening to audiobooks, I would say that there's kind of, I've seen more moral hand-wringing about the audiobook.
Yeah, hand-wringing
the massive sort of societal shift of people no longer interacting with service workers.
I want to draw a distinction here, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there is a debate about self-checkout and gasoline, and that debates about labor and debates about, and so I don't want to at all trivialize those debates or say by implication that those don't matter, because of course they do. And in the case of Why is there no self? Why is there no pay at the pump in New Jersey? I believe that statute is entirely related to jobs.
I looked it up once because I didn't quite buy it. There is apparently some mob involvement.
Okay. Now we're way out of my expertise.
Yeah. But... as a lay scholar of New Jersey, that is my understanding. It's New Jersey and Oregon. They're the only two states. But that is the official reason, yeah, that it was creating these gas station attendant jobs, that if we had self-service, those jobs would be lost, which is true.
Sure. I just don't want to make sure
we're talking about the moral elements of these debates, not that there are or aren't debates. Yeah.
And this issue of nostalgia and things like that, which is distinct, I think, from these. I just don't want by implication to downplay these other things, because of course they're
critical questions.
They are great. Yeah. Anytime we're talking about automation, and nowadays, anytime we're talking about automation, we are talking about computers. And so all of this, it would be a mistake to. But in terms of our private kind of psychological, I mean, this audiobook thing is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I suppose one way to defend audiobooks is very simple. And that is that for most of human history, there were only audiobooks. it was only oral storytelling. And, I love to look at, when you look at texts in ancient Greek or in papyrus or early, most ancient texts, you don't see punctuation, you don't see spaces. You often see boustrephedon, where things are written as the ox plows. I draw for when I look at that sort of thing, I mean, I am brought to the conclusion that writing really began as storage. We were storing oral, the orality saying things out loud, talking, having conversations, brokering agreements. That was the primary thing. This was the secondary. The writing part was the secondary. Now what's interesting about what you said is you may know much more about this than me, that there's a concern, at least in some quarters, that some essential skill or cognitive ability or affordance or some essential mental piece of gymnastics or something will be lost if we're listening and not reading. And that, now I have no expertise as a cognitive scientist.
Me neither.
No, right. But I will say that this is a rather extraordinary turn of events in the history of the world, because you don't have to go back very far, only really a few centuries, to find people feeling that reading is unambiguously bad for you. It is bad for your eyes, it is bad for your brains, and most of all, it is bad for your morals. And it's especially bad for the morality of young women who are reading these romances. I mean, within the space of only 300-400 years, we go from that to one of the great campaigns of your profession, the posters of Kermit the Frog, that say read, right? Like reading, we somehow in the space of a few centuries transformed reading from a morally questionable activity to something that is, of all things, actively good for you. A kind of like, eat your vegetables, vitamins for the brain. I mean, how did this happen? And this is incredible, isn't it? I mean, to hear people worried about audiobooks. I have no idea I don't teach young children or anything. I don't know what's at stake there, but it is at least interesting.
And I think a lot of it is not about that. It's about this, I think a lot of what I've seen in my, and I think this is an increasingly unpopular opinion this idea that listening to audiobooks is fundamentally different from reading a print book. But a lot of it is not about that at all. It's not about early literacy, whatever. It's really about the idea that this is a fundamentally different activity, which I suppose it is, but sort of the implication of it being fundamentally different and worse, right?
Fundamentally different.
Like, of course, listening is different from reading. That's not what the actual argument is. The argument is that listening is worse.
Yes. I don't want to leave your listeners with the impression that I could, do you remember, as I was saying, coming off as someone who's, you know, gloriously unafraid of any future. My wife does, she will listen to things at double time or triple time. She has to absorb some, I feel like this is just absolutely, you know, against some, that this is morally offensive. I mean, I just like,
there is something there. But why?
Right, so I have the same question for myself. Why does that strike me? I guess we have to admit that these are emotional things, and
I think that's that's how we got onto this, is your point about the attachment people have to these information technologies. Is there is something emotional there. There is some sort of romance. They're rarefied in some way. I mean, it's a whole literature about what people are responding to that is very interesting. But yeah, it's not always, I think we're not always, I will say I have the same reaction that you do about this listening at a pre-time speed thing. Like, I'm thinking about it. I'm sitting here. Why would that matter to me? But it does.
Yeah. Well, and I find I don't really have good reasons. And maybe, you know, I mean, this comes back to what the book is about. You know, I feel like we have people out there writing for the New Republic and the LA Review of Books and the, you know, fairly prominent organs of talking about books and talking about academia and so forth, Chronicle, Higher Education, and so forth. And a lot of people who feel really as if, and felt 10 years ago and 15 years ago, that the sky is falling with this digital stuff. And I sort of knew that we were, I knew, and I think perhaps they knew too, that we were having an emotional argument and that what was really at stake here was not, ultimately we were not talking about ebooks versus books. We were not talking about pens versus keyboards. It sounded like that at times, but what was really at stake will we have as rich an intellectual experience as spiritual an experience, you know, the moment of surprise, the moment of discovery, all the things for which we value the intellectual life and the life of the mind, can we have those with computers? That was really the question, and I think almost everything I've written has been addressing that question away, the experiences you can have with computers are different, but yes, you can have. I don't like triple speed audio, you know? And you are free not to like text analysis. But if the worry is that we are taking a rich intellectual experience, getting rid of it and replacing it with a barren intellectual experience, I think that's not true. I doubt I will repent ever having argued. That in particular, I really that just has not been my experience of computers and of working with computers. I shouldn't say my experience of computers. My experience of using computers to study history, literature.
I'm going to link for listeners in the episode notes I don't know if this essay exists in open access form, but certainly the things you're discussing do. This response to Stanley Fish in 2011, I think a lot of the debates that you're talking about really, I think, is this the moment that you're talking about this 10, 15 years ago when there's all of this sort of public debate about the value of the digital humanities?
Yeah.
Well, so I'm gonna link some of that because I don't know if we have time to get too into that. But for any listeners, I'll put that in the notes.
I really hope Stanley Fish is listening to this podcast. I don't know what the chances of that are, but I hope, you know, Professor Fish is an extremely learned and very voracious consumer of. So I would really love to send him that essay.
I mean, whenever I write something and I cite someone, I cold email it to them. I actually appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. He's such a giant in my field. He's
right.
Maybe I will. Maybe I'll just send it off to him.
Yeah. Okay, we'll keep it to a few more questions. Let's end it on this, actually. I think this is a good question to wrap up with. I mean, the word under-theorized comes up quite a bit, I think generally from critics of digital humanities saying that this pursuit is under-theorized and you're responding to them. But I'm wondering, what are the theories of DH? And also, are there elements of the discipline that are under-theorized? And what are those?
Yeah, the answer to the last question is yes, and hopefully so, or what will we do? I mean, hopefully there are things we haven't sufficiently reflected upon. Of course, when people say something is under-theorized, one suspects a kind of a slur, you know.
Right. It's not a compliment.
It's a polite way of saying, you know, people aren't thinking deeply enough, I don't think people are asking for a theory. And I also, I'm not sure that DH, and here I can, plenty of people can, I can imagine a level very articulate disagreements with what I'm saying, but I don't think digital humanities as a field advances a particular theory of anything. If by theory we mean I understand a theory to be something like some kind of narrative, some kind of framework, some kind of way, habit of mind, or way of thinking that has a certain kind of explanatory power, right? And this, of course, I mean, you know, in the sciences, we have theories, you know, of evolution that, you know, say, or relativity or whatever, so, you know, something that has explanatory power with respect to natural phenomena. I think something like this is true in the humanities as well. Except, you know, we're trying to explain the post-colonial condition, and we, and again, I think this brings us back to pattern. We develop ideas by looking at regularities and patterns and things like that. We develop frameworks in which to think about certain phenomena. So there are lots of theories put forth to offer explanatory, you know, there are lots of explanatory frameworks for lots of explanatory things. But digital humanities is kind of a meta-discipline in that way. I mean, I think it doesn't itself provide explanatory frameworks. What it might do, though, is offer deep thinking, I hope, about methodology, about methods of doing things. What are they good at? What are they bad at? What is gained? What is lost? And I hope that if the charge is that we are we're under theorized, we're not doing our job with respect to that, the answer is probably yes. And as I said, I hope so. But I don't think we, in the sense that one would hope that we are as reflective as we can be. But I don't think DH is represents a particular framework for looking at the world or a particular framework for looking at literature. I you know, you're asking a question that as I mutter on here, becomes more complicated the more I think about it. I'm interested. Now I want to go find out what other people think about that. But I don't think
I would love to hear.
Yes. I mean, but what so I mean, I've been accused of being under theorized more times than and again, I always detect a certain kind of slur that it's sufficiently reflective and hopefully, to the degree that is an invitation to a certain kind of skepticism toward what is being assumed or what is being, I hope we continue to be. I hope all humanists are regularly charged with this malady, because this is a good thing to. We have blind spots in DH all over the place. I do. Everyone does. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's good. Although, if I may, I think there's another way in which that is being used, and that phrase being used, it means, you people are down with the Frankfurt School or cultural studies and that, right? What they really mean is, honestly, I think some are and some aren't. That's a trickier question. Some people do come at DH precisely from those sorts of angles, and some don't. But many don't. But so often it means, you know, you're not using the same telescope I'm using, or microscope. You're using a theoretical framework I would prefer.
I think that everything you just said is a very useful way of thinking about the theories of digital humanities for me. And I think that's a good place to end off. So thank you so much for joining me this afternoon, and for sharing more about your book that I hope people now go get and read.
Indeed, thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking to you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book and all this other stuff.
I'm tired. All the thumbs up.
Amen.
All right. Thank you so much.